Hello, it's time to read the Des Moines Register for today, Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Pat Steele, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Deanna Snyder. For the first hour, we'll cover local national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Today's forecast, mostly cloudy, mild. Winds will be out of the north, 7 to 14 miles per hour, high expected of 57. Turning out clear tonight, winds will be lighter, 4 to 8 miles an hour out of the north-northeast. Tomorrow, looking at mild conditions with some sunshine and a high of 59. And Thursday, could be some rain, a high of 55. Our normal high for this year is 40, or for this time of the year is 43 degrees. Normal low is 25, so we'll be above that. Record high was set back in 1921 at 76 degrees, and record low minus 9 in 1978. Sunrise today, 6:42 a.m., and sunset tonight at 6:10 p.m. Now from the main section or front page of Des Moines Register, Iowa poll shows that Trump is dominating Biden in early tests of 2024 match. Low-key Super Tuesday for the Democrats and justices restore Trump to the ballot. From the Metro and Iowa section, Ankeny man sues over control of game. What to know about an Urbandale project and a new emergency trailer will help keep Iowa's pets safe after disaster. So let's look at our weather and headlines. Now here is Deanna with her first story.
Thank you, Pat. Well, Trump dominates. dominates Biden. Okay, in early test of 2024 rematch, up 15 points among likely voters, Haley loses favor. This is from Breanne Fannin Steele. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump would nearly double his margin of victory in Iowa over incumbent Democratic President Joe Biden if a rematch of their 2020 contest were held now, a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll shows. In an early test of the expected matchup, Trump leads Biden by 15 percentage points among likely voters, 48% to 33%. Among 15% of poll respondents, another 15% would vote for someone else, 1% would not vote, and 2% are not sure. In 2020, Trump defeated Biden in Iowa by about 8 percentage points. Donald Trump's a businessman. He's not a career politician, said Gregory Robleski, a 44-year-old Dubuque resident and poll respondent who has supported Trump since 2016. When he was in office, back to his first term, our economy was booming. There were no wars across the world. Our border was getting secured. We were taking care of our own people. It was a better place to live. The findings come as Iowa Democrats prepare to release the results of their first ever mail-in caucus Tuesday evening, and as 15 other states and one territory vote in Super Tuesday primary elections. Biden is not facing serious challengers and is expected to win Iowa's Democratic caucuses and once again claim his party's nomination. But his reelection effort comes as Democrats raise new alarms about Biden's ability to hold together his winning 2020 coalition and overcome voters' fears about his age. Trump soundly won Iowa's Republican caucuses in January, and he is on pace to easily clinch the Republican Party's presidential nomination over former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. Iowans' desire for change in the White House is reflected in their dismal approval ratings of Biden's job performance. Fewer than one-third of all Iowans, 29%, say they approve of the job Biden is doing in office, and 69% disapprove. At the same time, 79% of Iowans say things in the country have gotten off on the wrong track, while just 17% say things are going in the right direction. Another 4% are not sure. Almost all Republicans, 95%, share that negative outlook, but Democrats are more divided. 45% of Democrats say things are headed in the right direction, but a majority, 52%, think things are on the wrong track. Among independents, 80% say things are on the wrong track, and just 16% say things are going well. The poll of 804 Iowa adults was conducted February 25th to 28th by Seltzer and Company of Des Moines, and it has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. The questions of 640 likely voters have a margin of error of plus or minus 3.9%. If either Trump or Biden is elected president in November, he would be the oldest person to ever be sworn in to the Oval Office. But a greater share of Iowans say they are concerned about Biden's age than they are Trump's. More than half of Iowa adults, 56%, say Biden at 81 years old is too old to serve a second term. A quarter say Biden's age is somewhat of a concern, and 17% say his age is not a concern. Another 1% are not sure. Even many Democrats express concern about Biden's age. A third, 33%, say his age is not a concern, but a plurality of 39% say it's somewhat of a concern, and 27% say Biden is too old to serve a second term. Majorities of both Republicans, 75%, and Independents, 57%, say Biden is too old to serve another term. Lisa Wells, a 58-year-old Burlington resident and poll resident, is among the Democrats who expressed concerns about his age. "I just think that physical and cognitive abilities should be taken into consideration as candidates are aging," she said. "I don't know that their priorities align with people in the population." Wells said she plans to vote for Biden despite those concerns, primarily because she can't stand to see Trump in office again. "I just definitely don't want Trump," she said. Although Trump is just a few years younger at 77, a smaller share of Iowans say they are concerned about his age. According to the poll, 42% of Iowans say Trump's age is not a concern. 35% say it's somewhat, and 22% say he's too old to serve a second term. Another 1% are not sure. A majority of Republicans, 61%, say they are not concerned about Trump's age. Another 31% say that's somewhat of a concern, and 8% say he's too old. A plurality of Democrats, 40%, say Trump is too old to serve a second term. And a plurality of independents, 40%, say Trump's age is just somewhat of a concern. Andrew Gull, a 27-year-old independent voter, said he voted for Trump in 2016 and 2020, but would likely support someone other than Trump or Biden in 2020. He said, "Part of it is due to their age. I don't really think either of them is fit mentally or capable for being able to muster the important position of public office, and I don't think they can really properly handle the strain that it brings on people." Despite facing a bevy of challengers ahead of Iowa's Republican caucuses in January, Trump ultimately sailed to a nearly 30-point victory over his closest challenger, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, earning 51% of the vote. Still, Trump's detractors argued that nearly half of Iowa Republicans registered their preference for someone else. Haley, who remained in the race going into Super Tuesday, has said this makes Trump a weak general election candidate. But the Iowa poll results show that Trump is still consolidates the support of a large majority of likely Republican voters in this early test of a general election matchup. According to the poll, 89% of likely Republican voters say they would vote for Trump over Biden. Trump also retains a majority of those who voted for him in 2020, with 91% saying they plan to vote for him again in November. Another 5% say they will vote for someone else, and 2% say they will vote for Biden. Biden is about on par with Trump among members of his own party, earning the support of 88% of likely Democratic voters. But he retains a smaller share of his voters from 2020 compared with Trump. Among those who said they voted for Biden in 2020, 79% say they plan to vote for him again in November. 17% say they will vote for someone else. 2% say they will vote for Trump. But Trump leads with independents, 37% to 31%. Another 27% of independents say they would vote for someone else. Gull, the independent poll respondent, said he hopes to see a viable third-party candidate on the ticket in November. That's because, despite voting for Trump twice, he now finds him morally repulsive, following the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. His routine denial of the 2020 election results and the string of 91 felony charges currently leveled against him. But he also thinks Biden has failed to deliver on key campaign promises around issues such as student loan forgiveness, and he thinks Biden is wrong to offer blind support for Israel in its war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. I mean, if it really came down to a sole choice between Biden and Trump, I kind of hate the comparison of lesser evils. I don't love Joe Biden by any means, but I think he's done a decent job, everything considered. Pollster J.N. Seltzer, president of Seltzer & Company, said the poll shows a continuing decline in Biden's favorability numbers, as well as a sizable jump in Trump's popularity. Biden has the lowest favorability ratings of his presidency, with 31% of Iowans saying they have a favorable view of him, which is down from 34% in March. And 68% say they have an unfavorable view of him, up from 64% a year ago. Meanwhile, Trump is performing better than he was a year ago. Today, 49% of Iowans say they have a favorable view of the former president, up from 42%, and 48% say they have an unfavorable view, down from 57%. Haley, who is still in contention for the Republican nomination for president, is much better known now than she was in March of 2023. Last year, Haley was unknown to 44% of Iowans, and that has dropped to 11% today. But last year, more Iowans viewed Haley favorably, 31%, than unfavorably, 25%. That has flipped today, with 36% viewing her unfavorably and 54% viewing her unfavorably. Haley, who finished third in the Iowa caucuses, has not yet won a primary state and dramatically trails Trump in the delegate race, but she remains well-funded, and she has not said whether she intends to continue campaigning beyond Super Tuesday. This is from Breanne Fannin-Steele. Back to you.
Thank you, Deanna. Elsewhere on the front page of Des Moines Register, last week it was the girls' state tournament. This week the boys take over. There's a big picture on the front page of the Register. It says the boys' state tourney is on. Shows a picture of Mason Becken of North Lynn putting up a shot Monday against Woodbine during a Class 1A quarterfinal of the state boys basketball tournament at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. North Lynn, which is top seeded, won that game 75-59 to advance to tomorrow's semifinals. The state tournament continues through Friday's championship games in all four classes here in Des Moines. Low-key Super Tuesday for Democrats. No fanfare expected over caucus results, and Breanne Fannin-Steele wrote this article. Iowa Democrats are preparing to release the results of the first-ever mail-in presidential caucus Tuesday evening with none of the usual fanfare or festivities that have surrounded past caucuses. Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said unofficial results will be announced on the party's website and in a news release at 5 p.m. There will be no gathering spot for Iowa Democrats, no watch parties, and no onslaught of breathlessly waiting media. Hart said, I think that the important thing is that Iowa Democrats will know that this process was smooth, it was easy, it was accurate, it was transparent, and that the results are going to be clear to everyone. And when we get that all done, it may seem, I don't know if anticlimactic is the right word, I would just say that we will be relieved that this step of the process is done, and we're proud that we were able to do it in a way I think is going to be beneficial to Iowa Democrats. Iowa Democrats no longer stand alone at the front of the presidential nominating calendar, but instead are nestled among 15 other states and one territory that are casting votes on Super Tuesday. The change came after National Democrats stripped Iowa of its first-in-the-nation status following a disastrous 2020 showing when a tight race and glitches with vote reporting app combined to delay results for days. Although Iowa Democrats fought for months to retain their cherished spot, which helped give Iowans outsized political clout for decades, state party leaders ultimately conceded to the Democratic National Committee's demands and opted for a Super Tuesday contest. The state party adopted its absentee caucus as a way to reduce the barriers to participation that had plagued its traditional caucuses. Potential caucus goers who worked night shifts, couldn't arrange for childcare, or faced transportation or mobility challenges, often could not participate in the in-person caucuses. Under the new system, Iowans kicked off their caucus process November 1, 2023, when Democrats could begin requesting presidential preference cards. Those cards worked functionally like a ballot and include the names of President Joe Biden, author Marianne Williamson, and U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota. Iowans could also choose to say they were uncommitted to any of the candidates. Those cards were mailed out beginning January 12th, and the Iowa Democratic Party is still accepting any card that is postmarked by March 5th. That means Tuesday's announced results will be unofficial, Hart said. The party plans to allow 3 days for late arriving preference cards to be returned before announcing final results on Friday, March 8th. The party's state central committee will vote to certify the final tally at its March 16th meeting. Hart said the DNC's decision to replace Iowa at the front of the calendar has been a tough one, I think, for all of us to swallow. But she said it's also created opportunities for the party to reimagine its caucuses. In total, 19,609 Iowans requested a mail-in preference card this year. That exceeds the 15,000 Iowa Democrats that the party says caucused in 2012, the last time an incumbent Democrat was on the ballot. Hart said she's hopeful the return rate will be high. But the 2024 caucuses are essentially a soft launch for 2028, when Democrats will have a wide-open nominating race without an incumbent. Hart said, next time it is going to be much more competitive, and so it's possible that we may send out preference cards to every single registered Iowa Democrat. I think that would be great if we could make that happen. We could offer Dropbox locations or expand the window in order for more people to participate. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. All right, justices restore Trump to ballot. This is from Maureen Groppi of the USA Today, out of Washington. The Supreme Court said Monday that Colorado cannot use an anti-insurrectionist provision of the Constitution to kick Donald Trump off the ballot. The ruling leaves it to voters to decide whether the former president should be returned to the White House after he tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The court unanimously reversed the Colorado Supreme Court's December decision that Trump is disqualified from running for president by a constitutional amendment enacted after the Civil War to keep insurrectionists from holding office. In an unsigned opinion, the justices did not evaluate whether the January 6th attack on the Capitol was an insurrection or whether Trump engaged in it. Instead, they said the Constitution makes Congress, not the states, responsible for enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. We conclude that states may disqualify persons holding or attempting to hold state office, the justice said, but states have no power under the Constitution to enforce Section 3 with respect to federal offices, especially the presidency. However, the three liberal justices criticized the conservative majority's opinion and said the court went farther than necessary to help Trump. The Colorado challenge was high court's biggest presidential election case since Bush v. Gore in 2000. That decision split among ideological lines, whereas Monday's ruling was more united despite the widening of political divisions in this century. Notre Dame law professor Derek Muller said the contentious insurrectionist issue will remain live and disputed in the public domain in the months to come. But Monday's decision, he said, shuts the door on any exclusion of Trump from the ballot in any state, either in the primary or the general. In addition to Colorado, Maine's Secretary of State had declared Trump ineligible, a decision that, like the one in Colorado, was put on hold until the Supreme Court weighed in. A judge in Illinois likewise said Trump should be removed from the state's ballot. Colorado and Maine are among the many states holding primaries today, or Tuesday, I'm sorry. The court's three liberal justices agreed that allowing Colorado to remove Trump from the ballot would have created a chaotic state-by-state patchwork. During oral arguments, these justices voiced concerns similar to those of the conservative majority that allowing one state to disqualify a national candidate would be a recipe for disorder and confusion. But they wrote a separate statement criticizing the majority for going further than they said was necessary in order to insulate Trump and the Supreme Court from future controversy. Elena Kagan and Justices and Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson said, "We cannot join an opinion that decides momentous and difficult issues unnecessarily. The majority attempts to insulate all alleged insurrectionists from future challenges to their holding federal office." Writing separately, Justice Amy Coney Barrett also said she would not have gone as far as her fellow conservative colleagues. But in her two-paragraph statement, Barrett sought to turn down the temperature by emphasizing where they agreed. She said, "In my judgment, this is not the time to amplify disagreement with stridency. The court has settled a politically charged issue in the volatile season of a presidential election." She wrote, For present purposes, our differences are far less important than our unanimity. All nine justices agree on the outcome of this case. That is the message Americans should take home." Trump, in a post on his Truth Social platform, called the decision a big win for America. "Today's decision, especially the fact that it was unanimous, 9-0, is both unifying and inspirational for the people of the United States of America," Trump told Fox News Digital. Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, the watchdog group representing the Colorado voters who challenged Trump's eligibility, criticized the justices' ruling. "In letting Trump back on the ballot, they failed to meet the moment," CRU President Noah Bookbinder said. "It is now clear that Trump led the January 6th insurrection, and it will be up to the American people to ensure accountability." Trump has accused his opponents of trying to defeat him through anti-democratic methods. "Keeping him off the ballot would disenfranchise the tens of millions of Americans who want to vote for him," his lawyers told the Supreme Court. Trump's lawyers also rejected the charge that Trump was to blame for the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol that attempted to stop Congress's certification of the election results. They argued the attacks were a riot and not an insurrection, as that term is used in the 14th Amendment. Lawyers for the four Republican and two independent Colorado voters who challenged Trump's eligibility argued it was Trump who tried to disenfranchise the 80 million people who voted against him in 2020 by refusing to accept that he lost. But even some Democrats were uncomfortable with the ballot changes for practical or other reasons. "What always gave me political anxiety was it was the worst of all worlds," Dan Pfeiffer, a former top advisor to President Barack Obama, said on the podcast that he co-hosts. "He was going to be off the ballot in one or two states that were non-competitive, so we would not be stopping Donald Trump, an insurrectionist, from coming to the White House. We would just be giving Donald Trump, an insurrectionist, the opportunity to weaponize decisions by a few states that may help him return to the White House as an insurrectionist." Pat, back.
Thank you, Deanna. And related story, Governor Reynolds supports the Supreme Court's ballot ruling. Other Republicans also hail the victory for Trump. Kate Keeley wrote this article for the Des Moines Register. Republican public officials from Iowa championed the Supreme Court's rejection of Colorado's attempt to exclude former President Donald Trump from the presidential ballot. The court's unanimous decision reversed the Colorado Supreme Court's December ruling that banned Trump from the ballot through the 14th Amendment's anti-insurrectionist provision. Maine Supreme Court also declared the former president ineligible for its ballot. So what do Republican state officials say about the Supreme Court's ruling? Well, Governor Reynolds released a statement on the ruling Monday morning in support of the Supreme Court's ruling. In it, she called the Colorado Supreme Court decision an attempt to subvert the will of the American people. She added, "Not only would this disenfranchise Coloradoans, but Iowans as well, who believe Donald Trump is the best candidate on the ballot. Frivolous attempts like this to harm the integrity of our election should be struck down in a similar fashion." The Iowa Secretary of State's office filed a bill in late January to prevent Iowans from challenging Trump's place on the ballot on 14th Amendment grounds. Iowa GOP Chairman Jeff Kaufman agreed with Reynolds, stating in a news release that the ban was a power grab, attempting to cause election interference. Kaufman said, The checks and balances worked against an unbalanced, unhinged effort to trash the Constitution and take away the right of people to vote in a free and fair election. Even the most liberal Supreme Court justices agree that the real threat to American democracy is from the radical left. While the ruling decision was unanimous, the three liberal justices wrote a separate opinion criticizing the majority's opinion. Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, and Ketanji Brown Jackson argued that the majority attempted to insulate Trump from future challenges regarding his eligibility for federal office. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson signed an amicus brief advocating for the appeal of the Colorado ruling. The state court's decision was disastrous, according to one of Hinson's Twitter posts. In that post, she said, liberal justices never had the right to disenfranchise voters by trying to remove Trump from the ballot. A victory for voters and democracy, Americans deserve to have their voices heard. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst posted a portion of the ruling to Twitter, stating it should be up to voters to decide who is on the 2024 ballot. U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra also took to Twitter to support the court's ruling. He said, today's unanimous decision by the Supreme Court upholds our Constitution and restores the right of the American people to elect their leaders. President Trump has every right to remain on the ballot in all 50 states. Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. Okay, Kamala Harris talk with rival angers Netanyahu. Hamas box at giving out hostage information. This is from John Bacon of USA Today. Vice President Kamala Harris was scheduled to meet Monday with an Israeli war cabinet member and longtime rival of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu one day after calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The meeting is viewed in Israel as a warning from the Biden administration to Netanyahu, who has refused global demands for a two-state solution to the Middle East crisis and has pledged to continue the war in Gaza until Hamas is crushed. Harris was set to meet with Benny Gantz, who joined Netanyahu's government in a show of solidarity over the Hamas-led attack on Israel on October 7th, which killed 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and took roughly 250 people as hostages into Gaza, according to Israeli authorities. Gantz, a centrist, is taking heat from his own government for making the trip. Also scheduled were talks with Secretary of State Anthony Blinken and other top U.S. officials. An official from Netanyahu's far-right Likud party, who spoke with the Associated Press on condition of anonymity, said Gantz's trip was not authorized by Netanyahu. The prime minister chastised Gantz, telling him that the country has just one prime minister. Harris made news on Sunday with her call for an immediate ceasefire. She said, people in Gaza are starving. This is in Alabama to mark the 59th anniversary of Bloody Sunday when Alabama state troopers clubbed peaceful civil rights marchers. The conditions are inhumane and our common humanity compels us to act, she said. The U.S. has previously refrained from calling for a ceasefire, but along with Qatar and Egypt, has been trying to mediate a six-week truce that would lead to the release of hostages and enhanced aid for Gaza. Hamas's leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, hasn't been in contact with his own negotiating team for at least a week, raising concerns that a ceasefire deal could be held up, awaiting Sinwar's approval, Egyptian and Qatari officials told the Wall Street Journal. Israel has refused to send a delegation to ceasefire talks in Cairo, demanding that Hamas first provide an accounting of which hostages are still alive. Israel took the stance one day after the Biden administration said Saturday that Israel had essentially agreed to a six-week ceasefire that would include the release of some hostages, but the Hamas has yet to sign off on the deal. A senior Hamas official told the BBC that it is impossible to know which militant-held hostages are still alive because of a continuing Israeli bombing. Bassem Naim said the hostages are in different areas held by different groups and that a ceasefire is needed to track them all down. Naim also said that valuable information about the hostages could not be given, quote, for free, unquote. Hundreds of demonstrators, led by Unacceptable, which is a group of Israeli expat activists gathered outside the Red Cross building in Washington, D.C., demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. Among the speakers was Boaz Atzilli, whose nephew Aviv was killed during Hamas's October 7th incursion. Aviv Atzilli's body has not been released by the militants. The number of people killed in Gaza has risen from 30,000 with more than 70,000 wounded, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Israel blames civilian deaths on Hamas, saying militants operate among the population. More than 100 hostages held in Gaza were released during a week-long truce in November in exchange for 240 Palestinian prisoners. An unpublished investigation by the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Affairs has accused Israel of abusing hundreds of Palestinians detained in Gaza during the war. The New York Times reported, saying it had reviewed the report. The authors of the report allege that the detainees, including at least 1,000 civilians later released without charge, were held at three military sites inside Israel. The report said the detainees included males and females whose ages ranged from 6 to 82, some of whom said they were beaten, stripped, robbed, blindfolded, sexually abused, and denied access to lawyers and doctors. Some died in detention, the report said. The report was compiled by UNRWA, which is under investigation after at least 30 of its 13,000 employees were determined to have participated in the October 7th attack on Israel. An incident in the Red Sea has cut three underwater sea cables providing internet and telecommunications around the world, as the waterway remains a target of Yemen's Houthi rebels, officials said Monday. A statement by Hong Kong-based HGC Global Communications acknowledged the cuts, but did not say what caused the lines to be severed. There has been concern about the cables being targeted in the Houthi campaign, which the rebels describe as an effort to pressure Israel to end its war on Hamas in Gaza. The Houthis have denied attacking the lines, however. Meanwhile, U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein arrived in Beirut on Monday for meetings with Lebanese leaders aimed at avoiding escalation of the clashes between Israel and Iranian-backed Hezbollah militants. American opinion of Israel and of the Palestinian Authority have worsened in the past year amid the escalating crisis, according to a new survey. The Gallup poll shows 58% of Americans have a very or mostly favorable view of Israel, down from 68% last year, and the lowest favorable rating for Israel in over 20 years. Young adults show the biggest decline, dropping from 64% favorable among 18 to 34-year-olds in 2023 to 38%. Positive opinion of the Palestinian Authority has also fallen to 18% from 26% a year ago. Republicans overwhelmingly sympathize with Israel. Independents tend to favor Israel, and more Democrats side with the Palestinians than Israelis, the poll shows. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. We'll now turn to the Metro in Iowa section. Before we get to the stories there, there's a large picture here on the Metro in Iowa section, and the headline is Capital City Pride Gala Goes Over the Rainbow, and it's a picture of Master Ceremonies Matt Weiss as he introduces the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus at the Capital City Pride 2024 annual gala on Saturday at the River Center in Des Moines. There's a number of people standing behind Master Ceremonies Matt Weiss, all on risers and bleachers. This is an annual event and was themed Over the Rainbow and was held to honor companies and community members who work to promote and strengthen the LGBTQ plus community in the area. And the picture was taken by Lee Navin of the Register. Our first story from the Metro in Iowa section, the Ankeny man is suing over control of a game. He contends a Texas firm infringes on his copyrights. Clark Kaufman wrote this story for the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A certified therapeutic game master from Iowa is suing a Texas company for libel, slander, and copyright infringement over a planned Dungeons & Dragons spinoff. Sean Thomas and his Ankeny company, Tabletop Adventure, are suing Geek Therapeutics and its founder, Dr. Anthony Bean, who is a licensed psychologist, in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Iowa. The lawsuit revolves around Thomas's development of a role-playing tabletop game called Realms of Chimoria. The lawsuit claims that players of the game inhabit a fictional world that provides an inclusive and welcoming environment for all types of individuals. Thomas alleges that in creating Realms of Chimoria, he produced graphical maps, stories in the form of written prose, and graphic depictions of various characters within those stories. In 2021, he created a limited liability company called Tabletop Adventure to hold the copyrights, trademarks, and other rights associated with the game. That same year, the lawsuit alleges, Thomas acquired his Therapeutic Game Master certification from Geek Therapeutics, signaling his ability to host role-playing games in therapeutic environments. Soon thereafter, Thomas and Bean allegedly began discussing a potential licensing agreement whereby Geek Therapeutics would manufacture, market, and distribute Realms of Chimoria. The lawsuit alleges Thomas was concerned about losing control of the intellectual property rights associated with the game and that Bean agreed all such rights would remain with Thomas. Negotiations continued through December 2022 when it was learned that a California company called Wizards of the Coast was planning major changes in its licensing agreements that allow third parties to create games using rules that are compatible with its popular Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game. Among the planned changes was one that would grant to Wizards of the Coast a perpetual royalty-free license to use the officially licensed third-party games for any purpose. The lawsuit claims this plan triggered an uproar in the tabletop gaming community because many game developers had created business models centered on their compatibility with Dungeons & Dragons rules. Thomas was among the concerned developers because he had intended to make Realms of Chimoria compatible with Dungeons & Dragons, but was opposed to the Wizards of the Coast licensing arrangement, according to the lawsuit. Geek Therapeutics, however, opted to pursue compatibility, and it moved forward with its marketing plans for Realms of Chimoria. Despite the alleged lack of a finalized licensing agreement between Thomas and the Texas company, Geek Therapeutics launched a Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign to get Realms of Chimoria to market. In April 2023, Thomas allegedly demanded that Geek Therapeutics immediately cease all efforts to reproduce and distribute his game. According to the lawsuit, Geek Therapeutics announced earlier this month plans to distribute and sell the game through its Kickstarter campaign. Hundreds of people have pre-registered to provide support for the game, the lawsuit claims, and various websites and merchandise have been created to promote and sell the game. In addition to an injunction, Thomas's lawsuit seeks damages for copyright infringement, as well as libel and slander, with Thomas allegedly alleging that the defendant sent its Kickstarter backers a supportive email that falsely claimed to be from him. The defendants have yet to file a response to this lawsuit. And you can find this story at the Iowa Capital Dispatch, which is a part of the state newsroom, a network of news bureaus supported by grants and a coalition of donors as a 501c3 public charity. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. What to know about Urbandale Project? Land being cleared along Interstate 35. This is from Philip Jones. Drivers on Interstate 35 can see a sizable tract being cleared just south of Bob Brown Chevrolet and the Douglas Road exit. So what's going on? In August, Ankeny developer Todd Reuter bought about 37 acres of 3600 11th Street in Urbandale, abutting the Bob Brown Chevrolet dealership, known for its ever-changing display of vehicles next to a large sign facing the highway. The property consists of neighboring lots, an 18.32-acre parcel, and an 18.39-acre parcel, according to the Polk County Assessor's Office. Reuter Company paid $1.29 million and $1.54 million, respectively, for the tracts, according to the Polk County Assessor's Office. Reuter, the CEO of Reuter Properties, a commercial real estate firm in Elkhart, did not respond to a request for comment. So how big is the property? The property is one of the largest undeveloped tracts left in Urbandale. Derek Zarn, a spokesperson for the city of Urbandale, said Reuter bought the land at 3288 111th Street from Living History Farms, which abuts just to the south. Though the site is being prepared for grading, no project has been identified, Zarn said, and according to county records, the zoning remains agricultural. Axios reported in December that Living History Farms plans to reinvest proceeds from the sale in its facilities. The land was formerly occupied by a home and a disused service station. A permit to remove the house was filed last year, according to the assessor's office. So who is Todd Reuter? Reuter is the youngest son of family patriarch Cecil Reuter, who died in 2020, and leads the family business. In 2018, the younger Reuter famously traded Ankeny Mansions and billionaire pesticide and fertilizer mogul Dennis Alba. Cecil Reuter founded Grand Junction Farm Implement Firm, Reuter's Equipment, and was known for his generosity. In January 1972, he paid for a four-day vacation for 13 employees and their spouses to the Bahamas after his company hit its goals for the previous year. Today, the Reuter family also owns Reuter Properties, its development arm. Pat.
Elsewhere from the front page of the Metro in Iowa section, new emergency trailer will help keep Iowa's pets safe after disasters. Rana Falberg of the Ames Tribune wrote this article. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans and the Gulf Coast in 2005, the tragedy seemed to be endless. One of the many heartbreaking scenarios during and after the storm was the impact it had on family pets. News reports showed images of people who had to leave their pets behind to seek shelter. Some Katrina victims refused to leave without the furry members of the family because emergency response plans did not accommodate pets. It's hard to know the exact number of dogs, cats, and other pets affected, but the Animal Welfare Institute estimates as many as 250,000 pets were separated from their families and approximately 150,000 died. Those tragedies inspired something good, however. AKC Reunite, an affiliate of the American Kennel Club, developed emergency trailers that can help communities on a daily basis and be deployed to disaster areas during times of need. AKC Reunite's 110th Pet Disaster Relief Trailer was donated to Newton on February 27th, the first donation in the state of Iowa. The trailer will generally be used in Poweshiek and Jasper counties, where it will do things like help reunite lost microchip pets with their owners. In the event of tornadoes, floods, or other disasters, the trailer can provide relief for pets in any of Iowa's 99 counties. Just last year, the area experienced such severe weather, the governor declared a disaster. And that's from Tom Sharp, president and CEO of AKC Reunite, and he said that in a news release. He continued, "Now the local emergency management will have the materials they need when disaster strikes." AKC Pet Disaster Relief Trailers have equipment to create a safe place to house at least 65 pets for 72 hours after a disaster is declared. With crates and carriers as well as a universal microchip scanner, the trailer is an emergency shelter for animals. The trailers are also equipped with the necessary bowls, collars, and leashes as well as fans, lighting, and a generator, cleaning supplies, and maintenance items. AKC Reunite, the largest nonprofit microchip identification and recovery service in the United States, sponsors AKC Pet Disaster Relief. It partners with AKC dog clubs and pet lovers to make the trailer donations possible. Newton's trailer was made possible by the Central Iowa Kennel Club, Poweshiek County Alliance, and Grinnell College. Christina DeLisi, president of the Central Iowa Kennel Club, said in a news release, "The Central Iowa Kennel Club is proud to partner with AKC Reunite, Poweshiek and Jasper County Emergency Management Agencies, and Grinnell College to bring Iowa our first AKC Reunite Pet Disaster Relief Trailer. Iowa regularly experiences tornadoes and other severe weather that can devastate whole communities. This trailer will be a resource for all 99 counties to keep pets safe during these emergencies as well as reuniting them with their owners. Brian Paul, the coordinator at Poweshiek County Emergency Management, acknowledged in the news release that it existed for a long time. Paul said, "We are excited that this is the first trailer of its kind in Iowa. It will undoubtedly be a valuable resource to our two counties, and we look forward to the partnerships and increased resiliency it creates. The trailer will enhance communities' capacity to care for beloved animal companions during emergencies," said Jamie Robinson, the EMA director at Jasper County Emergency Management. And he said, "Together, we are building a resilient community that extends its protective embrace to every member, ensuring that no pet is left behind in times of crisis." Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. Okay, a couple of brief stories on page 3. Residents' death draws $6,000 fine for assisted living center. This is from Clark Kaufman of Iowa Capital Dispatch. An assisted living facility in Ames has been fined $6,000 for a regulatory violation tied to the death of a resident. In the past 3 years, 3 resident deaths have led to state citations against Northridge Village Complex in Ames, which includes both a nursing home and a state-licensed assisted living center. According to state inspectors, a female resident of the assisted living center returned to the facility from a shopping trip at 5 p.m. on December 29, 2023. Over the weekend, the woman's family made several attempts to contact her, but calls to her cell phone went unanswered. About 5 p.m., 2 days later, a relative of the woman went to Northridge Village to check on her and found that her apartment door was locked. With the assistance of the staff, the relative entered the apartment and found the woman on the floor next to her bed. The woman was conscious and reported that she might have broken her ribs. At a nearby hospital, she was diagnosed with dehydration, 7 cracked ribs, and atrial fibrillation. The woman was moved to a hospice unit, and she died within a matter of days. The director of the facility allegedly told inspectors the woman's 24-hour emergency response pendant, which is a regulatory requirement for residents of Iowa's assisted living centers, did not function properly. According to the inspectors, the pendant had been, quote, deactivated by mistake, unquote. Although an inspector's report doesn't state who deactivated the device or how the deactivation occurred. According to the report, Northridge Village could not determine the exact time and date the pendant had been deactivated, but estimated it happened sometime after Christmas. The inspector's report gives no indication as to when the woman might have fallen or how long she remained on the floor before being found. She had been a resident of Northridge Village for 9 weeks and had paid for the independent living level of service, which included no routine welfare checks, according to the state records. In November 2021, the Northridge Village skilled nursing facility was cited for the death of a resident who fell to the floor during an improper transfer in or out of bed. In November 2022, the nursing facility was cited for a death that was tied to an untreated urinary tract infection. And then an article from Jose Mandiola of the Des Moines Register. A 20-year-old is identified in a fatal Davenport crash, according to police. Police have identified the person who died in a Davenport car chase this past Sunday as a 20-year-old man from Illinois. The driver, who was operating a 2011 Nissan Maxima shortly after midnight, attempted to elude the Iowa State Patrol while northbound on East 53rd Street and North Brady Street, according to a crash report. The driver has been identified as Javier Villarreal of Rock Island, according to the report. The chase ended after Villarreal lost control and crashed. The Iowa State Patrol said Villarreal died at the scene. The State Patrol had received a call of a reckless driver going at a high rate of speed, Public Resource Officer Luke Hank said. Villarreal got so far away from police that a pursuing state trooper didn't see the crash happen and drove past it, Hank said. He didn't even see what happened. He said he actually just smelled the accident, and that's how he went back and found him, Hank said. Villarreal didn't have a seatbelt on when the crash happened, according to the report. As of Monday, the Iowa State Patrol has not said why he was eluding police. The crash is still under investigation, Hank said. There have been 32 traffic deaths so far in 2024 in Iowa as of Monday morning, according to data from the Iowa Department of Transportation. Pat.
And continuing with a couple of other stories on the page three of the Metro section, Des Moines man sentenced to probation for deadly crash. Again, Jose Mendiola wrote this article for the Register. A Des Moines man who was charged with vehicular homicide over a motorcycle crash that killed his passenger in 2022 has been sentenced to 2 years of probation. Wesley Darrell Sullivan, age 51, pleaded guilty February 27th to the October 2022 crash that killed 35-year-old Linz Ross. Sullivan allegedly was driving 60 miles per hour in a 35-mile-per-hour zone with a blood alcohol level above the state's 0.08% limit. As part of the plea agreement, Sullivan received a 15-year suspended sentence. He must enroll in a victim impact awareness program at DMACC and must pay $150,000 for victim pecuniary damages, according to court documents. Sullivan was driving a motorcycle north on 19th Street at a high rate of speed on October 30th, 2022, when he hit a car in the intersection of 19th Street and the Interstate 235 off-ramp, police said. Police found shattered bottles of alcohol near the scene. Ross was critically injured and died at a hospital a few days later after the crash, police said. Sullivan was ordered to maintain full-time employment, pursue a full-time course of GED or post-secondary study, or a full-time combination of employment or study as part of the plea agreement. According to court documents, Sullivan was also barred from owning a firearm as part of the plea agreement, according to court documents. And in our final story from the Metro and Iowa section, a body found near University Avenue on the west bank of the river. Kyle Werner of the Register wrote this article. A body was found near the Des Moines River on Saturday morning. The Des Moines Fire and Police Department received a report of a deceased adult male near a homeless camp just after 10 a.m. The body was found on the West Riverbank a few blocks north of the University Avenue Bridge. A Des Moines police spokesperson, Sergeant Paul Parizek, said there are no indications to suggest criminal actions contributed to the death of the unknown male. Des Moines police are awaiting the cause of death to be confirmed by medical examiners. Authorities have not revealed the name of the deceased male. Deanna?
Thank you, Pat. This is from page 7 of the main section. Trump Organization's former CFO pleads guilty to perjury. This is from Bart Jansen of USA Today. Alan Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer for the Trump Organization, pleaded guilty to perjury Monday for lying at former President Donald Trump's civil fraud trial. Prosecutors in Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's office had accused Weisselberg of lying under oath when he answered questions in a deposition in May and at the October trial about allegations that Trump lied about his wealth on financial statements given to banks and insurance companies. Weisselberg will be sentenced to 5 months in jail, the judge said. Sentencing is scheduled April 10th. His lawyer, Seth Rosenberg, said in a statement, Alan Weisselberg looks forward to putting this situation behind him. Weisselberg has already served a jail term for tax fraud and falsification of business records in an unrelated case, but he received a $2 million settlement when leaving the Trump Organization and hasn't cooperated with government lawyers while testifying at Trump's fraud trial. The civil fraud trial resulted in a $454 million judgment against Trump for inflating the value of his real estate to get benefits such as lower interest rates from lenders. The perjury conviction could serve as a warning to other witnesses in Bragg's trial against Trump on criminal charges of falsifying business records, which is set to begin March 25th. Trump has pleaded not guilty. During Trump's civil fraud trial, Weisselberg testified in October that he never focused on the square footage of Trump's penthouse apartment in Trump Tower. Trump's financial statements listed the apartment as nearly three times the actual size of 10,996 square feet, which resulted in a $200 million overstatement of its value. But Forbes magazine had discussed the apartment's value with Weisselberg for years while estimating Trump's net worth. New York Judge Arthur Engoron wrote in his judgment about the case that Weisselberg's testimony was intentionally evasive with large gaps of, quote, I don't remember, unquote. Pat.
Thank you, Deanna. Switching to a little weather-related story, wind increases struggle to contain Texas wildfires. Valerie Gonzalez of the Associated Press wrote this article, and the dateline is McAllen, Texas. Strong winds spread flames and led to a town's evacuation while airplanes dropped fire retardant over the northern Texas panhandle in an attempt to stop the largest wildfire in state history. As of Sunday afternoon, the Smokehouse Creek fire was 15% contained and two other fires were at least 60% contained. Authorities have not said what ignited the fires, but strong winds, dry grass, and unseasonably warm temperatures fed the blaze. A cluster of fires have burned across more than 1,900 square miles in rural areas surrounding Amarillo. The largest blaze, Smokehouse Creek, accounted for nearly 1,700 square miles spilled into neighboring Oklahoma. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas on Sunday said the federal government has devoted funds, equipment, and personnel to assist with battling fires, but warned more extreme weather could be coming. More than a million acres have burned, and we are in winter, and this is the largest fire in Texas history, Mayorkas said during a CNN interview. We, as a country and as a world, have to be ready for the increasing effects of extreme weather caused by climate change. It's a remarkable phenomenon, and it will manifest itself in the days to come, and we have to prepare for it now. The National Weather Service late Sunday warned of an elevated fire risk due Monday in the area due to winds of 15 to 20 miles per hour. Strong winds spread the flames, prompting an evacuation order to be issued in Sanford, a Texas town of a little more than 100 residents, according to a post by the Amarillo office of the National Weather Service, and that was on X, which was formerly Twitter. As firefighters fought the unprecedented wildfires, humanitarian organizations pivoted to victims who have lost their homes and livelihoods. Residents began clearing affected property on Saturday, and by Sunday, the extent of the loss began mounting. Donations ranging from $25 to $500 have been critical for the Hutchinson County United Way Wildfire Relief Fund, which is dispersing proceeds to displaced families. We already know that a large group of people are uninsured who lost their homes, so without monetary assistance, it's going to be very hard for them to start back over, said Julie Winters, who is the executive director for Hutchinson County United Way. The organization has heard estimates of more than 150 homes being affected in the county, noting the fires extend to at least five other counties, Winters said. A steady outpouring of donated clothing, water, and hot meals quickly overwhelmed one community in the affected area. The city of Borger, Texas, urged people in a social media post to redirect donation efforts from food and water to clean up supplies, including shovels, rakes, gloves, and trash bags. And maybe time for one more story before birthdays, Deanna.
Thank you, Pat. I think we've done all the articles. I'm going to switch to the 50 states. We'll start with of that. Out of Austin, Texas, Houston resident Elizabeth Francis has lived a long time, long enough to set the end of Jim Crow laws, the Civil Rights Act signed into law, the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the fall of the Soviet Union, and the first black president to be elected. Francis was born in Louisiana on July 25th, 1909. At 114 years of age, Francis is the oldest living person in the United States, according to LongevityQuest, which is a nonprofit that accounts for human longevity around the globe. According to the Gerontology Research Group, Francis is also the fifth oldest supercentenarian, a person who lives to be 110 years old, in the world, and has a picture of here with a crown on. So, and then out of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, Alabama Senator Katie Britt will deliver the Republican response to President Joe Biden's State of the Union address on March 4th. From Anchorage, Alaska, the nine communities served by Raven Alaska, the state's biggest regional airline, can expect to see fewer flights after 130 employees were laid off, according to Alaska Public Media.